easy. That, oh, no, no, that'll never happen. But it just seems that the aches and pains last a little bit longer than they used to. But anyway, it's good to be back here again. Certainly enjoyed the opportunity and appreciate it as well. The Bible is filled with heroes. People who did not consider themselves as such. There were many people called by God for a chosen purpose. They were chosen to lead. Today we'll look at one of those people. He did not consider himself to be a leader, but he was considered a hero of faith. Like many others whom God chose, he questioned why God would call him to the role that he did. He needed to be convinced of his calling. We'll look at this individual's life, both the good times and the bad times. We'll see how he used an interesting strategy, a highly unusual strategy, to defeat an enemy. We'll see his rise to leadership and his fall from grace. Today, we'll look at the life of Gideon. Israel was on a roller coaster. As a nation, they would alternate between obedience to God and disobedience. When they were obedient, God delivered them from their enemies. When they were disobedient, God delivered them into their enemies' hands. Israel had a 40-year period of peace, as noted in Judges chapter 5 and verse 31. They were obedient at that time, and they were enjoying peace and independence. The next verse, Judges 6 verse 1, shows a change in attitude. Once again, they did evil in the sight of the Lord, as it states. And as a result of their disobedience, Israel was indentured to the Midianites for 7 years. And in addition to the Midianites, there were smaller contingents of Amalekites and Mesopotamians who would take advantage of the Israelites' situation. They would come down and raid the Israelites during the harvest season and confiscate the produce of the land. Not only that, but they would plunder their livestock as well. The Israelites fled to higher ground into caves in order to save whatever they could from those who invaded their land. And it provided a sense of security for them as well. They were able to store some of the produce in the cave that they made. And they were able to save themselves as well. Judges chapter 6, verses 1 through 5 provide the account. And all this sets the stage for Gideon to come onto the scene. It gives some background information that is vital to the story. Judges chapter 6, verses 1 through 5. And the children of Israel, verse 1, did evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian for 7 years. And the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel. They were stronger than Israel. Because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made for themselves the dens, the caves, and the strongholds which are in the mountains. They tried to hide from the oppression of the Midianites. Verse 3, so it was, whenever Israel had sown, that is, they planted their grain, the Midianites would come up, and also the Amalekites, and the people of the east would come up against them, and they would encamp, or put their army in position against them, and destroy the produce of the earth as far as Gaza, and leave no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep, nor ox, nor donkey. For they would come up with the livestock and their tents, coming as numerous as locusts. Both they and their camels were without number, and they would enter the land to destroy it. The Israelites were being plundered by their enemies, a sign that God was not part of Israel because of their disobedience. The Israelites realized that they were in trouble. They knew they needed help. They were being looted by the Midianites and the Amalekites, and they realized that they could not make it on their own. They needed help. What do we do when we need help or when we're in trouble? It's usually at that time that we ask God to help us. Just the human condition. Rather than being proactive, that is, asking God to help us as we go through our daily life, We as humans are usually reactive. We wait until a crisis comes into our life, and then we react. We ask for help when we're already in trouble. And the Israelites were no different in that respect. Once they realized they were in trouble, it seems that it was at that time that they asked for divine intervention. Verse 6 points that out, Judges 6, verse 6. So Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. God heard the cry, the prayer, and the plea of the Israelites, and God did send someone to rescue them. But notice what they were told. Verse 7. And it came to pass, when the children of Israel cried out to the Lord because of the Midianites, that the Lord sent a prophet to the children of Israel, who said to them, Thus says the Lord God, the God of Israel, I brought you up from Egypt, and brought you out of the house of bondage. And I delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians, and out of the hand of all who oppressed you, and drove them out before you, and gave you their land. Verse 10, I also said to you, I am the Lord your God. Do not fear the gods of the Amorites, in whose land you dwell, but you have not obeyed my voice. This key phrase. God reminded them as to why they were being oppressed. They were not obeying God, as verse 10 points out. And that was the cause of their distress. We're now introduced to a new person, a man by the name of Gideon. His life is covered in three chapters in the book of Judges. This is the only book in the Bible where his name is mentioned. Gideon would be the person that God chose to deliver the Israelites. Verse 11 of Judges 6. Now the angel of the Lord came and sat under the terebinth or the oak tree, which was in Ophrah, which belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, while his son Gideon threshed wheat in the winepress in order to hide it from the Midianites. There's a reference to hiding the food stores. Remember that the people were raided by the Midianites and the Amalekites, and they took their grain and their livestock. Gideon, whose name means he who cuts down, was trying to preserve some food and keep it from getting into the wrong hands. But there might be more to it than that, as we'll see. The angel appeared to Gideon and called him a mighty man of valor, as verse 12 states. Gideon certainly didn't see himself that way. He did not see himself as a powerful person. He was. Why would he be hiding? Throughout the Bible, God often refers to people according to what they will become rather than what they are. There is an implication in the meaning of Gideon's name that he has the essence of being an overcomer. And as we'll see, that's what happened. Gideon then questioned the angel about why the people were in the condition they were in. He wondered why God had forsaken them. He wondered why God had left them in the hands of the Midianites, as verse 13 states. And Gideon said to him, Oh my Lord, if the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us? And where are all his miracles, which our fathers told us about, saying, Did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt? But now the Lord has forsaken us and delivered us into the hand of the Midianites. Well, the short answer to Gideon's questions is right back to verse 1, where it states that the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. There are blessings for obedience and consequences for disobedience. Now, it seems that Gideon did not make the connection. On the other hand, he was stating what was true, so perhaps he did understand. But verse 14 shows the mission that God gave to Gideon. And the Lord turned to him and said, Go in this might of yours. Again, there's a reference to the mighty man of valor. Go in this might of yours, and you shall save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have I not sent you? Now, Gideon's response was somewhat typical. Many of the leaders God chose gave a similar response. They all thought that they were not worthy of the calling that they were given. They came up with excuses and reasons as to why they should not be used in the role that God chose for them. Moses and Jonah, two examples that come to mind immediately, and there are many, many others. But notice Gideon's response in verse 15. So he said to him, "O my Lord, how can I save Israel? Indeed, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house." So Gideon came from the smallest of Manasseh's clan, and he thought himself as being very unimportant in that respect. He said he was the least in his house, implying that he was the youngest, the smallest, and the least important member of the family. He was clearly not a man of influence or wealth. But then, 1 Corinthians 1, verse 26 reminds us that not many wise, not many mighty, not many noble are called. But Gideon certainly fit that description. It seems Gideon's concerns were somewhat short-lived. He believed and trusted God and lived up to the confidence God had in him to become a mighty man of valor. He eventually lived up to the meaning of his name. Here's a lesson for us too. How often have we wondered why God chose us? What does God see in us as individuals? And we can come up with excuses, we can come up with reasons as to why we're not fit in the role that God has for us. But we have to remember that God knows what he's doing, and he has his reasons for calling us now. And we must obviously take that calling seriously. But it's the natural human condition to doubt. Why would God call me? Now, I have so many flaws, I have so many character issues. Why would God choose me? Well, God knows what he's doing. Verse 16 gives God's response to Gideon's concerns. Verse 16, "And the Lord said to him, 'Surely I will be with you, and you shall defeat the Midianites as one man.'" Interesting. The next several verses go through the details of the offering that Gideon made as a sign that he was talking with God. Verse 22 shows that Gideon was certain of that. Verse 22, "Now Gideon perceived that he was an angel of the Lord. So Gideon said, 'Alas, O Lord God, for I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face.'" He's beginning to realize that this was the job that God gave him to do. Verse 23, God gave another promise to Gideon. "The Lord said to him, 'Peace be to you. Do not fear, you shall not die.'" But God would deliver him throughout this, whatever it was that we will find out that God had in store for him to deliver the Israelites. All these things helped Gideon to give up. And as it turned out, Gideon needed more confidence. But that came later on, as we'll see. Gideon's first task was to destroy the altar of Baal. Verses 25 through 32 give the details of the destruction of the altar and the challenge that was put to Baal to save people. In spite of this victory, Gideon still needed a little more confidence. Still wasn't quite there yet. He still needed more assurance from God. He needed more proof that God was working with him. He needed another sign. The famous story of the fleece is detailed beginning in verse 36. "Then Gideon said to the Lord, unto God, 'If you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said,'" well, he knew that God would save them. And Gideon continued, "Look, I will put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there is dew on the fleece only, and it is dry on all the ground, then I will know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said." Verse 38, "And it was so. He rose early the next day and squeezed the fleece together. He wrang the dew out of the fleece, a full bowl of water." But that still wasn't enough. Still wasn't quite enough for Gideon. Now he wanted to see the opposite. Verse 39, "Then Gideon said to God, 'Do not be angry with me.'" Okay, God, I'm back here again. I still need a little bit more help with this. "Don't be angry with me and let me speak just once more." Sounds rather familiar. "Let me test, I pray, just once more with the fleece. Now, let it be dry only on the fleece, and on all the ground let there be dew." This was the opposite now. So God did so that night, It was dry on the fleece only, but there was dew on all the ground. So Gideon was getting his confidence at this point. He was getting the confidence that he needed to lead the Israelites. But he was still walking by sight, and not by faith. But his faith was becoming stronger. The next chapter of Judges details the major battle for which Gideon became famous and lived up to the true meaning of his name, he who cuts down or is an overcomer. He also showed that he was indeed a mighty man of valor. Judges 7 verse 1, then Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, another name for Gideon, and all the people that were with him rose early and encamped beside the well of Herod. So that the camp of the Midianites was on the north side of them by the hill of Moreh in the valley. And the Lord said to Gideon, the people that are with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel claim glory for itself against me, saying, my own hand has saved me. So God realized that the Israelites could be filled with pride and give credit to themselves, credit for the victory to themselves rather than to God with that number of people. Verse 3, now therefore proclaim in the hearing of the people, saying, whoever is fearful and afraid, let him turn and depart at once from Mount Gilead. And 22,000 of the people returned, and 10,000 remained. But this was still too many for God's liking. Verse 4, and the Lord said to Gideon, the people are still too many. Bring them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. Then it will be that of whom I say to you, this one shall go with you, the same shall go with you. And of whomever I say to you, this one shall not go with you, the same shall not go. So God was working with Gideon and the rest of the people. He was carrying down the numbers to a seemingly impossible low. And yet there was a purpose for that, as we'll see. Verses 5 and 6 detail how God reduced the number of those who would fight the Midianites and the Amalekites. Verse 5, so he brought down the people down to the water, and the Lord said to Gideon, everyone who laps from the water with his tongue as a dog laps, he shall set apart by himself. Likewise, everyone who goes down on his knees to drink. So God was using two different methods. Two different ways to sort those who would eventually take the Amalekites, the Midianites. Verse 6, and the number of them that lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, was 300 men. But all the rest of the people got down on their knees to drink water. So from 32,000 men down to a total of 10,000. Those 10,000 indicated that they would fight, but even that number was too high. God did not want the Israelites to think that they won the battle because of their own might, their own numbers. So now they were down to a mere 300 men, a seemingly impossible number to defeat the opposition who far outnumbered them, as we read earlier in chapter 6, verse 5. Now it's not clear why God chose this method to determine who would go into battle. It was, to say the least, a very interesting and unusual method. The Nelson Study Bible makes note of these verses. You can judge the merits of the comments on your own. Nelson Study Bible states that some commentators have suggested that the men who did not get down on the knees were maintaining a higher degree of military readiness by drinking out of their hands. However, they may be reading too much into the account, for the text does not indicate any reason for Gideon's preference. The reference to the way a dog laps might even be derogatory, since dogs were despised creatures in the ancient world, as they were considered worthless scavengers. And there are several scriptural references to indicate that. If so, God's role in the victory becomes even more apparent, since the 300 men who were left were the ones who did not even have the common sense to drink in a normal manner. God's comment in verse 7 seems to reinforce this suggestion. That's from the Nelson Study Bible on these verses. But again, you can judge the comments for yourself, the merit of the comments. But regardless of the methodology, the 300 who were chosen would end up with the victory. In addition to the unusual method of choosing the few men who would fight, there was also an interesting strategy that Gideon came up with to ensure the victory. He realized that God would give the victory, as he had promised, but nonetheless, Gideon would have to lead his army to that victory. So he came up with an interesting strategy. He detailed the next few verses. Verse 7, then the Lord said to Gideon, by the 300 men who have lapped, I will save you and deliver the Midianites into your hand. Let all the other people go, every man to his place. So again, from the 10,000 down to 300. So the people took provisions and their trumpets, the shofar or the ram's horn, in their hands. And he went away and all the rest of Israel, every man to his tent, and retained those 300 men. Now the camp of Midian was below them in the valley. That last statement was an important detail in Gideon's strategy, as we'll see shortly. Verse 12 shows what Gideon and his 300 men were facing. Now the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the children of the east were lying in the valley as numerous as locusts, and their camels were without number, as the sand by the seashore in multitude. The reference to the sand by the seashore in multitude is a familiar one. Genesis 22, verse 17 shows God's promise to Abraham that his descendants would be similar in number. Gideon's 300 men were facing enormous odds. They were obviously greatly outnumbered, but they had God on their side, and that made all the difference. Picking up the story in verse 16 now, then he divided the 300, as Gideon divided the 300 men into three companies, and he put a trumpet into every man's hand with empty pitchers and torches within the pitchers. Kind of an important detail. And he said to them, look at me and do likewise. So watch, do as I do. Watch me here. Watch, and when I come to the edge of the camp, you shall do just as I do. When I blow the trumpet, I and all who are with me, then you also blow the trumpets on every side of the whole camp, and say, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. So Gideon and the 300 men who were with him came to the outside of the camp, the beginning of the multitude, the beginning of the middle watch, just as they had posted the watch. And they blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers that were in their hands. Again, interesting detail. Then the 300 companies blew the trumpets. Sorry, the three companies blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers. They had the torches in their hand, in their left hands, and the trumpets in their right hands for blowing, and they cried, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. And every man stood in his place around the camp, and the whole army ran and cried out and fled. When the 300 men blew the trumpets, the Lord sent every man's sword against his companion throughout the whole camp, and the army fled to Beth Acacia, toward Zerah, and as far as the border of Abel Meholah and Tabah. So they were scattered in every direction. This was an interesting strategy that Gideon used. He gave each of the men, their 300 men, trumpets, pitchers, and lamps. So what was the significance of that? Well, trumpets had several uses, or have several uses in the Bible. They were used to sound a warning, sound an alarm. They were used to attract people's attention. They were used on festive occasions. And they were used to communicate important messages. The sound made by a trumpet made it ideal for these uses. The sound was strong, it was loud, and it was long, a lingering sound. It had to be because it was also used to gather the Israelites, as we can read back in Numbers chapter 10, verse 2 and verses 4 through 6. You want to go back to that later, Numbers chapter 10, verses 2 and 4 through 6. Verse 2 shows that two trumpets were to be used. Now the sound had to carry great distances in order for the camps to hear it. In contrast, 1 Corinthians 14, verse 8 states that if a trumpet gives an uncertain or an indistinct sound, well, what good is that? Who's going to prepare himself for battle? In other words, the trumpet had to be heard to be effective. It had to be loud to be heard. Now, two trumpets were used for the Israelites. Imagine what 300 trumpets must have sounded like. The attack was carried out at night, so the Midianites could not see who was attacking them. Each of the 300 men had trumpets, pitchers, and lamps. Now, normally, only the commander of a group would have a trumpet. So again, what's the significance of that? Well, by giving each man a trumpet, the illusion was that a great army was attacking the Midianites. And the same applies to the lamps. The sound of the pitchers breaking would have sounded like armor, especially as the sound carried down the walls of the valley at night. The walls would amplify the sound of the trumpets and of the pitchers. And in the confusion, the enemy fled. Different directions, without the battle gear, and even killed one another in the ensuing melee. The darkness, coupled with their panic and desperation, helped to give Gideon the victory, just as God promised would happen. The trumpets played an important role in this battle. It was the sound of the trumpets that helped create confusion among the Midianites. All in all, it was an interesting military strategy that Gideon used to great effect. And thus God used an insignificant person by the name of Gideon to defeat the enemy and give 40 years of peace. Gideon lived up to his name and overcame the opposing forces. But in spite of his great victory, all was not well. After the climactic victory, there was trouble brewing. The Ephraimites, who were called in after the battle to help complete the victory, as shown in Judges 7, verse 24, were upset that they weren't called sooner. Gideon was very diplomatic in his reply, though. The Ephraimites felt they were left out here a little bit. Judges 8, verse 1 through 3 give the details of Gideon's reply. Judges 8, verse 1. Now the men of Ephraim said to him, "Why have you done this to us by not calling us when you went to fight with the Midianites?" And they reprimanded him sharply. Interesting. So Gideon said to them, "What have I done now in comparison to you?" I'm turning the tables here a little bit. "Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Ebiezer? God has delivered into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb, and Zeb. And what was I able to do in comparison with you?" And their anger toward him abated when he said that. Again, a very diplomatic response to the anger, the venom that was coming out from the Ephraimites. Gideon told the Ephraimites that they did a far better job of cleaning up than he could have done. And besides, they captured two princes of Midian, a major victory in itself. But still, all was not well. When Gideon and the 300 men came back from the battle, notice not one person was killed, he was refused provisions. Remember God's promise, "You shall not die." So, came back with his 300 men, and now they're refused provisions. Although they won the battle with Midian, they were still pursuing their other leaders. It wasn't quite over. The major battle was over, but there were still some skirmishes to be dealt with. Judges 8, verse 4, when Gideon came to the Jordan, he and the 300 men who were with him crossed over, exhausted, but still in pursuit. You can understand they were exhausted, but they were still in pursuit. In verse 5, then he said to the men of Succoth, "Please give loaves of bread to the people who follow me, for they are exhausted, and I am pursuing after Zeba and Zalmunna, kings of Midian." And the leaders of Succoth said, "Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in your hand, that we should give you bread to your army?" So in other words, where are they? You haven't got them yet. Why should we give this to you? So Gideon said, "For this cause, when the Lord has delivered Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, then I will tear your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars." Well, there will be consequences for their attitude here. The elders of Succoth also mocked Gideon, implying that they had not really done anything to deserve the provisions that Gideon asked for. But But Gideon had every right to make this request of his fellow countrymen. The response that he got showed his loyalty. Then the same thing happened later on. Peniel. Verse 8, then he went up from there to Peniel and spoke with them in the same way. And the men of Peniel answered him as the men of Succoth had answered them. So he spoke also to the men of Peniel, saying, when I come again in peace, I will break down this tower. After he captured the kings he was pursuing in verse 12, Gideon returned to Succoth and to Peniel and carried out what he promised in verses 7 and 9. After all this, the people of Israel wanted to make Gideon their king. But Gideon realized that God was king over them. If he was humble enough to realize that. Verses 22 and 23 now. Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us, both you and your son and your grandson also, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian. And Gideon said to them, I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you. Notice what happened next. The standard of the day allowed Gideon to do what he did, up to a point. Verse 24, then Gideon said to him, I would like to make a request of you, that each of you give me every man the earrings of his plunder, for they had gold earrings because they were Ishmaelites. So they answered, we will gladly give them. And he spread out a garment, and each man threw into it the earrings of his plunder. Now the weight of the gold earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold. That comes out to more than 45 pounds of gold. Besides the crescent ornaments, the pendants, the purple robes that were on the kings of Midian, and besides the chains that were around their camels' necks. Those are quite a bit of jewelry here. And it was at this point that Gideon did something foolish. It's something he probably should not have done. Like, he should not have done it and probably realized it later on, hopefully. But nonetheless, rather than being humble about his leadership, he let it go to his head. Verse 27 tells what happened. Then Gideon made it into an ephod and set it up in his city, Ophrah. Remember, that's where the angel came to him, city of Ophrah. And all Israel played the harlot with it there. They worshipped it. And it became a snare to Gideon and his house. The ephod was a ceremonial religious garment. It became an idol to the Israelites, and they began to worship it, contrary to God's command not to do so. So Israel was falling back into worshiping idols. It was also the beginning of the end for Gideon. Nonetheless, Israel enjoyed 40 years of peace after the defeat of the Midianites, as verse 28 points out. Up to that point, there was obedience, once again, to God. Gideon died at a good age, as verse 32 states, and he was buried with his father. The tide was still turning, though. Israel was falling back into their old habits, including idol worship. The last three verses of Judges 8 show how quickly and deeply Israel went back to their old ways. Verse 33. And it came to pass as soon as Gideon was dead that the children of Israel again laid the harlot with the Baals and made Baal-berith their god. So they went back to idol worship. Verse 34. Thus the children of Israel did not remember the Lord their God, who had delivered them from the hands of all their enemies on every side. Amazing. Verse 35, nor did they show kindness to the house of Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, in accordance with the good which he had done for Israel. It was like his memory was expunged from his deeds were expunged from their memory. And so the life of Gideon ends. It's interesting to note that Gideon probably did not actually become king of Israel, though he was the de facto king. He enjoyed the privileges of being a king. If he had been chosen as king, there would undoubtedly be a reference to that in the scriptures. But Gideon was a king in the eyes of the people. After his victory, he amassed quite a harem and had 70 sons born to him, as chapter 8, verse 30 points out. In fact, in verse 31, it states that one of his sons was Abimelech, which had a meaning of royalty. In fact, it was presumptuous of Gideon to name his son as such. But Gideon did leave a legacy behind. The next chapter of Judges gives the details of that legacy. And as we'll see, it was not all good. Let's keep our places in Judges and go back to Deuteronomy 17, verse 17 for a moment. Deuteronomy 17, verse 17. This section of scripture gives guidance as to the proper behavior of kings, but the principle applies to us as well. Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 17. Something to remember here. Again, talking about kings. Verse 17, neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away. Neither shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself. This shows a principle of humility, and not to get greedy and amass personal wealth. In other words, keep focused on God. So while Gideon was not actually a king, he acted like one, and the people thought of him as such. He should have known better. Perhaps the situation with the ephod clouded Gideon's thinking. And he allowed pride to enter and get in the way. Back to Judges 8, verse 30, points out that he had many wives, in contradiction with what we just read. Judges 9 gives some of the details of the legacy that Gideon left behind. Verse 1, and Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, went to Shechem to his mother's brothers, and spoke with them and with all the family of the house of his mother's father, saying, please speak in the hearing of all the men of Shechem, which is better for you, that all 70 of the sons of Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, reign over you, or that one reign over you? Remember that I am your own flesh and bones. So here is a case of lobbying going on here. Here is that Abimelech wanted to be king of Israel, unlike his father, at least at first did not want that position. Abimelech might have felt threatened, or perhaps he felt inferior to his brother. So he had to act quickly in his own mind. What better way to do that than circumvent everyone and just get right in there and start talking himself up, why he should be the king. Perhaps he felt inferior to his brother, so he had to act quickly. He was lobbying for the position of king. He was seeking support from his mother and her influential family. And in turn, she thought that she and her family might gain themselves by obtaining high position in Abimelech's administration. And like, you know, I wash your hand, you wash my hand kind of thing. Abimelech, in effect, put up a public relations team, as verse 3 states. And his mother's brothers spoke all these words concerning him in the hearing of all the men of Shechem. And their heart was inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, he is our brother. With some money in hand, Abimelech hired people to follow him and adored him. So it seems like his plan was working. Verse 4, so they gave him 70 shekels of silver from the temple of Baal-berith, with which Abimelech hired worthless and reckless men, or vain and light people, as another translation puts it. And they followed him. Wow. Notice where the money came from as well. It came from the temple that the Israelites returned to soon after Gideon's death. Referring to the vain and light people means unimportant. The word light in that context means unimportant. But basically, Abimelech hired people who adored him and followed him around, kind of like his groupies, or his cheerleaders, as it were. It was a sign of an insecure person. Furthermore, Abimelech literally eliminated his competition for the position of king. Verse 5. He went to his father's house at Ophrah, killed his brothers, the 70 sons of Gideon, on one stone. But Jotham, the youngest son of Gideon, was left because he hid himself. Only one brother survived, Jotham. And this was the way Abimelech became king over Israel. Verse 6 states, something else of note. Verse 6, And all the men of Shechem gathered together, all of Beth Milo, and they went and made Abimelech king beside the terebinth tree, the oak tree, at the pillar that was in Shechem. The plane of the pillar refers to a tree, as many translations state. We'll go back to Judges 9 in a moment. Let's go back to Genesis 35, verse 4. Genesis 35, verse 4. Interesting comparison here. Genesis 35 and verse 4. So they gave Jacob all the foreign gods which were in their hands, and all the earrings which were in their ears, and Jacob hid them under the terebinth tree, which was by Shechem. So many years before this incident involving Abimelech, Jacob had commanded his family put away all their foreign gods. And Jacob hid those objects at the very location that Abimelech was proclaimed king. If ever there was a definition of sacrilege, this is certainly it. Jotham survived the mass murder of his family. The next several verses in Judges detail the parable that Jotham gave relating to how Abimelech was chosen to be king. Jotham fled and hid from Abimelech for obvious reasons, and the price on his head. In the end, though, Abimelech died rather ignominiously. Judges chapter 9, verses 52 through 54. This was at the city of Thebez, which was being attacked by Abimelech and his army. Judges 9, verse 52. There was some bit of cowardice on Abimelech's part. So Abimelech came as far as the tower and fought against it, and he drew near the door of the tower to burn it with fire. But a certain woman dropped a piece of upper millstone on Abimelech's head and crushed his skull. Then he called quickly to the young man, his armor bearer, and said to him, "Draw your sword and kill me, lest men say of me, 'A woman killed him.'" So his young man thrust him through, and he died. Very interesting way of dying. Verse 56 shows that God is just. Another example here. Thus God repaid the wickedness of Abimelech, which he had done to his father by killing his 70 brothers. And all the evil of the men of Shechem God rendered on their own hands, on their own heads rather, and on them came the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbaal, the Gideon. So God does watch over his people. While the way God does things may seem unusual at times, God does know what he's doing. In this case, the wickedness of those involved brought this episode to a conclusion. We must never forget that those who seek to exalt themselves, as Abimelech did, will be abased. This was a legacy that Gideon left behind. What kind of legacy will we leave behind? Gideon's legacy was certainly not a good example, but nonetheless, there are lessons that we can learn. What then can we learn from Gideon's life? Gideon did not see himself as a leader. He was humble, for the most part. In the latter part of his life, he showed the opposite characteristic. However, he trusted God, though he did need convincing. He had lacked faith initially, but he did build that faith. He knew that God would give him the victory. He came up with a highly unusual strategy to defeat the enemy, showing that he was resourceful as well. So what can we learn from his leadership? Dr. John Maxwell, in his Leadership Bible, identifies 7 assets followers want in a leader. We'll see how these relate to Gideon. The first asset that followers want in a leader is calling. Calling. Few things are as compelling as a leader's clear calling. Beforehand, Gideon had lived in fear, doubted himself, and asked for multiple signs to confirm his mission. But once he embraced his calling, passion and boldness filled his heart. The second asset followers want in a leader is insight. Insight. People respect a leader with insight, wisdom to see the issues, and visions to see what lies ahead. God gave Gideon insight into the weak hearts of the Midianites. By the time Gideon called his men to battle, he understood that God had assured their victory. The third asset followers want in a leader is charisma. Charisma. People flock to leaders who make them feel good about themselves. When Gideon invited the people of Ephraim to join in pursuing the Midianites, they reacted angrily. But Gideon helped them to see the significance of their role by reminding them that they had captured and killed the princes of Midian. The fourth asset followers want in the leader is talent. Talent. Look no further than the entertainment industry for evidence that followers swarm around talent. While we don't know much about Gideon's natural abilities, the angel called him a mighty man of valor and instructed him to go in this might of yours. But more than likely, Gideon possessed both physical strength and courage, though he did not let that show through initially. The fifth asset followers want in leader is ability. Ability. People feel a natural attraction to someone who can get things done. Gideon didn't attempt to get the Ephraimites on board until he had proven his ability. The sixth asset followers want in leader are communication skills. Communication skills. A leader who cannot communicate his calling and vision has trouble getting anyone to buy into his leadership. Whenever Gideon spoke to his people, they understood him and eagerly followed. And the seventh asset that followers want in a leader is character. Character. It takes character to win and maintain trust. Gideon started out strong, standing up when others wouldn't. He displayed courage in the face of incredible odds. But in the end, a flaw in his character betrayed both him and the people. After his victories, Gideon created an idol and erected it at Ophrah. That's from the Maxwell Leadership Bible on Gideon's leadership. Those seven assets were evident in Gideon. He was called to be a leader. He did have insight. He did have charisma. He had talent. He had ability. He had communication skills. And he had character. What about us? What about us? Do we have these same assets or characteristics? Are we growing and preparing to be leaders in God's coming kingdom? What kind of legacy are we leaving behind? Well, today we looked at the life and times of Gideon, one of the most interesting leaders in the Bible. Again, not much was written about him. His life is covered in three short chapters in the Bible. It makes a fascinating study, though. He was a true hero. No, he didn't see himself that way initially. But he was chosen to lead. He was given a job by God. He accepted that calling. We saw how he used a most unusual strategy to defeat an enemy. We saw how he rose to his leadership role. He was not perfect. He was human after all. He had his faults and his flaws. But because of those faults and flaws, he fell from grace. He fell from that leadership role. But nonetheless, there are lessons that we can learn even today. We can learn many lessons from Gideon's life. Let's adopt those seven characteristics that made Gideon one of the heroes of faith, a true hero of the Bible.